What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Isaiah Jackson is the author of Bitcoin and Black America, Volumes 1 and 2. He is the host of Community Crypto on CoinDesk TV and has been featured in Forbes, CNBC, Fox Business, Yahoo Finance, and Black Enterprise. Isaiah Jackson, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix. How are you?
Doing great. How you doing, Cedric? Glad to be here, brother.
Awesome, man. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a really long time. I was just really inspired by your book when it came out. I grabbed it right away. You know, my background a bit, and I don't get into this too much, is, you know, I grew up on Long Island. I'm Jewish. I think most people would consider me white. I've always considered myself in maybe that community, except I don't really think of a lot of things in my everyday life as like being in this community or that community. But my parents happen to be public school teachers in New York City. They both taught in what, you know, people like used to euphemize as like the inner city. And I used to go into school, into their schools a lot when I was a kid, especially when my school was either closed for bad weather. And I got to experience not only going to a different neighborhood, but it was only 20 miles away, but I experienced the path and the drive to the different neighborhoods and how neighborhoods changed. And I contextually saw how my neighborhood was different, and there were pros and cons and stuff. So I'd just love to get into the book and a little bit about what you're up to. So I'm wondering, are you in Chicago? I know you just dropped a show about the Windy City, I think.
Yes, the show this week, actually tonight at 5 p.m. Yes, the Community Crypto, we're featuring Southside Blockchain Group, Block, and Informative Services on the show. And I'm not in Chicago. I'm actually not there. So right now we're doing it virtual, but eventually if we can get to a point where I can visit these cities on Community Crypto, looking to visit local crypto groups or Bitcoin groups, talk about different subjects, sort of like the Bourdain of Bitcoin, so to say.
Sure.
And I want the people who don't normally get to speak out to be on the show. If you watch it, as you can see, most of the show are people they've never heard of. And that's the best part, is these are the community people we need to talk to. Everybody doesn't need to be famous for you to listen to them.
Sure.
especially in this world, because there's a lot of people that put in a lot of work and they don't want to be famous, but they are very smart. You should know these people. So glad I could bring them on the show.
Yeah, I love the idea of this show and the platform and kind of visiting different communities. Are you seeing a lot of differences between the communities that you've been talking to in the first three episodes and their reception to Bitcoin and things of this nature?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, our first show, we featured the biggest Bitcoin group on Clubhouse, Black Bitcoin Billionaires. So a lot of people saw that and saw that, you know, teaming up with Cash App, giving away money, giving away Satoshis was a good thing. And then our second show, we talked about historically Black colleges and universities. A lot of people didn't realize that blockchain groups at a lot of these schools are a direct pipeline to huge businesses. And in our world, if you can get these jobs, they're scarce. They're more scarce than Bitcoin. These jobs, they can't find people to work for them. So if you can start at the HBCU level, get these groups going, you can have a pipeline of students for years. And then, you know, today featuring Chicago, the home of derivatives, right? And this is a finance city. And that's why, you know, I think the show is beneficial, because we do hit on these topics, and that's what we've done so far. But, you know, going forward, speaking to people in Latin America, looking at parts of Africa like Botswana, Ghana. So a lot planned, so people understand that this is a global thing and not just, you know, here at home in the U.S. Yeah,
I love that. And there's a lot we can go through there, and I think we will, especially as we kind of move through some of the things you discuss in the book. Just to kind of maybe table set a little bit, because, you know, you definitely come across as an educator, and it's what you're doing now, even with your show, you're meeting with communities and it's education. And even if that's like 360 degrees where you're learning from them, like you were just mentioning, you know, how you're kind of hitting off on how Chicago has the derivatives background and kind of that interplay. So how did you, you know, come to Bitcoin, and what were you doing before Bitcoin?
Oh, man. So I was a teacher right before I got into, you know, learning about Bitcoin. I was a high school teacher teaching computer science and game art design. I had students between the age of 14 and 20, and I was 23 at the time. I was young teaching, and, you know, teachers don't make any money. And me and my roommates were all like just getting out of college, first year, first job, not really making any money, thinking about different ways. And I have a roommate who comes home, and he worked for Charles Schwab. And he comes home and he's like, we talked about this thing called Bitcoin, but it's a technical thing. I don't know what they're talking about. Some computer money. You may understand it, Isaiah, because you have a tech background. So looked into it. And my first entry into Bitcoin was Max Keiser. So if you know Max Keiser, he's a very convincing person. Luckily, I saw him first. You know, some people don't figure it out till later, but saw him, saw an article by the Winklevoss twins. And, you know, I was at that point, I've always said people that started in Bitcoin back then were either pretty rich, so they didn't care about losing it, or pretty poor, so they were like, well, what do I have to lose? That was me. I was like, what do I have to lose? The money aspect was the start. But once I learned about the technology, learned how it can impact communities, that's when I kind of took off. Because the longer you stay in this, you understand this is bigger than just number go up. That's not what we're all in this for. Right. The ability to own your wealth, the ability to be self-sovereign. That's why I got into it. And then back then it was scary times. You know, I was called everything but a son of God during those times. It was like, it's a scam. It's multi-level marketing. Mm-hmm. It's what are you doing? Are you selling drugs? Are you, I mean, it was just weird times. So to see it today, and then from where I started, great to see. And I'm glad that I can impact people in my community who I've helped over the years. So That was my start.
What did you make of, that was awesome. There's a lot I want to also touch on there, even that Max Keiser pit. But first, what did you think about the public school system kind of being on the inside of it and how it operated? And now, like, kind of even contrasting that with what you've kind of thought about it since?
Oh, yeah. So my mother's been a teacher for 30 years. My grandmother was a teacher all her life. I have aunts who are teachers. Run summer camps, do things. So I have a family full of teachers. So I've seen the school system from a student point of view with a parent in it, then becoming a teacher, it's changed drastically. I mean, ridiculous. And you can see the change. Most people don't realize this, but after No Child Left Behind, 2002, 2006, that era right there where students were graduating and getting out while it was implemented, that's kind of when it changed. And I graduated high school in 06. And I just remember they were just passing anybody. They were literally just letting anybody go just to keep their numbers up. And when I got, by the time I became a teacher, I saw this practice and I was like, man, public school is lit. I mean, I had to have an interview with one of the school administration because they were like, we need more students to get better grades so they can pass through. And I was like, it's over for me. I'm out of here. But what I did see as far as public school is that there's an opportunity there. You just have to find outside avenues, after schools, summer camps, which I'm on the board of a group, Innovative Learning, 501c3 nonprofit. I'm teaching a Bitcoin summer camp this summer because in public school, I could never teach Bitcoin. It would be, they would ding you or do whatever, they would get you out of there. But in summer camp, I can teach them all day. They can learn, they can have fun with it. And with after school, they can reinforce it over, you know, through the years. So there's ways around it, but coming from a family of teachers, just seeing how public school has changed is crazy. And I think Bitcoin can help, right? A number of disciplines, you have economics, you have game theory, you have mathematics, you have engineering, cryptography. It's so much that comes out of it. We can actually revolutionize the system by starting people with Bitcoin. So definitely looking for that in public school. I hope they get some sort of curriculum where Bitcoin's included or we're going to be left behind.
That's awesome. Speaking of, so you graduated in 2006. Maybe how did the great financial crisis in a way affect you? And maybe how did it affect the, you know, the greater Black community?
Man, I was in college at the time and already broke. We putting money together to get stuff from the dollar menu on McDonald's at McDonald's. And then the financial crisis hits. I don't understand the financial system, but I started looking into it during that time because I was like, man, a lot of people had to leave school because their parents lost their house or they didn't have money. And it was just a crazy time. So from that point, how it impacted me was I realized something was wrong, but I didn't know what would fix it. You know what I mean? I was just like, well, we're kind of stuck. Once I started reading, Beyond the Pale Horse and, you know, Jekyll's Island and started kind of seeing how the financial system works. I was kind of like, this is weird. So we don't have a choice. Like we, the Federal Reserve just, they give it to the banks and the banks choose who to give it to. And I'm like, wow, this is crazy. So that time period, I did a lot of studying in the financial sector, learning, just building myself up. At the same time with the tech background, you put those together, Bitcoin is the purest form of fintech or financial technology. That's the purest form is Bitcoin. So I think it was kind of inevitable. And I think that 08 crash has pushed me to where we are now, where we might have something similar. And I'm prepared this time. Last time I was a scared 21-year-old and now, you know, I'm more prepared with Bitcoin.
Right. How do you think like inflation and what the Federal Reserve has done has affected the Black middle class?
Whew, man. You know, they say sometimes if the U.S. has a cold, then the Black community has a flu. So if it's bad, something's going bad. It seems going worse for us. And the thing is, with inflation, we're all affected. I mean, everybody watching this is affected by inflation. You're getting stolen. You're getting robbed without a gun. You're getting your money stolen from you, literally, by debasing the currency. So if people don't understand inflation, which I try to explain it like this, if you have a house full of things and slowly people take a lamp, somebody takes a fork and they take a plug out the wall. One day you're going to be sitting there and there's going to be nothing in your house at some point. And it happens slow. So you don't notice it until it's too late. Inflation for a lot of people, they don't notice it. They don't realize it, but they wonder why are prices higher? Why? The only thing not higher in prices from when you're younger is the Costco hot dog, right? They're never going to change that $1.50. but other than that, everything's gone up in prices. Wages have stagnated. So people are fleeing to a asset. What rich people have realized, you have to have assets that grow over time to keep up with inflation. And now that we have something that's a low barrier to entry, like Bitcoin, a lot of people are choosing that. And we see the results at this point. So inflation hits everybody and we got to do something about it. Bitcoin seems to be one of the answers.
Yeah. Yes, I agree. What do you think is sort of the relationship between Black America and the media?
Well, hasn't been fair a lot of times. A lot of what I've seen Black people portrayed as has been one-sided and on certain media outlets. And then on other sides, even if it is positive, it's sort of monolithic, meaning they think all Black people think this way. And that's one of the things that I don't like about media is that a lot of different views are portrayed as, well, this is the Black view and that's it. You know what I mean? But we have a lot of different views. We're not a monolithic group. And I think that the media could do a better job of getting different views from Black people, as well as the portrayal. I mean, every time something happens with a Black person getting killed by police, they put like the worst picture of them on just for portrayal to that he might have been a thug, might have been. And it's just like, come on, man. Like, how many years are we going to do this? And it works, right? I mean, there's some people who I really believe psychologically can't get out of their head the image of Black people being negative because of the media. The media literally can train you with that. Television is programming. It programs you a certain way. So even if you try, you'll just accidentally jump because you see somebody approaching you at ATM as Black. Like, just some people do that. And it you may not be able to really affect it, but some people are actually racist. So you're also worried about that. Unfortunately, for most people, they think about it way too much. For me, still got a lot to do. But yes, I think the media helps the narrative, but we're trying to change that now. Alternative media is becoming much more appropriate, I think, in these times. And we're getting away from that.
Awesome. Yeah. Heavy issues. I'm also wondering, like, how the banks treated the Black community over time, and maybe even like touching on like redlining and subprime loans.
Oh, yeah. So this system, the current financial system, what banks did, there's a few things I think that impacted wealth in the Black community. After the World War II, FHA loans came in the 1930s and 40s. These FHA loans were 98% of these loans were given to white Americans. Even though people fought side by side in the war, Black and white, World War II, came back home to nothing. 2% of all the loans. So you start there with real estate, people getting loans for houses that you can hold for decades, which we know is the cornerstone of most families' wealth. You start there. Then you move to banks. The neighborhoods that these houses were in, they literally drew red lines around them and said that this is where Black people are cannot stay or cannot live, or this is where the bad quote-unquote communities are. Then you had government projects where they built highways smack dab through a lot of Black neighborhoods. If you look at where I'm at in North Carolina, 85 goes straight through. That's why every time you get off a highway exit, it's in a Black neighborhood that's perceived as bad. That was on purpose. And you have a lot of industries, steel mills, trucking stops, things that will always keep the property value at a certain, there's a ceiling. It can't go any higher. That was on purpose. This was done by banks intentionally. And I hate when people say, hey, banks aren't racist today. I'm like, they made rules that were racist then, and all they do is keep the same rules to today. So certain zip codes get higher percentage interest rates. So it still continues, right, even if it's not, even if it's subconscious. So this is what banks did. This is how they've affected the Black community. And a lot of people only use banks because they feel like they have to. That's crumbling as we speak. I mean, literally, I had somebody explain the other day, they were like, so you mean to tell me I can get a stable coin, I can earn interest, I can buy Bitcoin, I can save my money, I can do all this without a bank? And I was like, yes. And this person that said this was 16 years old. That banks are gone, in my opinion. It's over for them. The kids are not using anything you have compared to what crypto and Bitcoin has brought. So, yes, I think that, you know, going forward, the future looks bright, man.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to affect, the banks won't affect us anymore.
Yeah. And to kind of hammer home on what you're saying, it's like, you know, it's like I grew up and you think of, especially around sports and music, is a meritocracy. And, you know, my favorite, I was a Michael Jordan fan. I want to be like Mike. You know, I was a Michael Jackson fan, King of Pop. I grew up watching Mike Tyson fights. And, you know, and I would go into the schools where my parents taught and the neighborhoods were different. And the thing that really struck to me, though, that was that these communities were disconnected from, you know, city infrastructure. Really, you know, it wasn't so much driven by anything internal as really the external forces on the community, the options within the community, the businesses that are in the community, the check cashing windows, the liquor stores, the lottery, but also just the subway system. Like you were talking about the highways, like the highway cuts it off and the subway doesn't run to that community. And they don't have access to something like Manhattan, like the other five you know, parts of the five boroughs do. And to also hammer this home, you know, in your book, you know, because you, and the reason I bring that up is you think, and the reason I bring up the cultural stuff is you think that, hey, I'm not racist or I'm not trying to be racist or all my heroes are you know, people who are not exactly like me. But to bring up what's still happening today and that you get in the book is that, you know, JP Morgan settles racist loan claims with $55 million payment January 2017. An African-American taking out a $190,000 loan on average paid $1,100 more over the first 5 years of the loan than a white borrower. I mean, so like, you know, Bank of America / Countrywide to pay $335 million for predatory lending. I'm not gonna get into the details. Merrill Lynch, $160 million racial bias settlement, August 2013. Wells Fargo, $175 million for racist lending practice, July 2012. And then you go on to, you know, Black community doesn't owe anything to the banking system. So, you know, these things are just still rampant and happening today. And I'm sure that, you know, the fines they're paying are nowhere near the profits they've extracted from those communities.
Not at all. Yeah. Right, and I hate these soft ass commercials they have with soft music in the background, a little girl playing in a lily field. Wells Fargo's always been there for you since 1870. Who gives a fuck? And then they go into this whole spiel. We gave $1 million to people in the community. And it's like you made that 10 minutes ago. Who cares? Like, your money is not, to me, we should be like, your money is not good here. We've seen the damage you've done. We want to move away from it. And that, at the very least, gives our community and every community leverage, because now they have to respect you. At the very least, they have to change their rules. At the most, they go away completely.
Yeah. And, you know, and as you also go on to say in the book, is as we enter the 21st century economy, you know, and here's my question to you. Can you tell us about the Black community's rich history of entrepreneurship, especially around, you know, the early 1900s and what historian Juliet Walker would call the golden age of Black business?
Yes. So a lot of people don't realize, outside of now, the second best time economically for Black Americans was the late 1800s, early 1900s. Because there was, at that time, there was no Federal Reserve until 1913. There were communities who were built on group economics, and the money that circulated amongst them made everybody better. We see this in practice today and it works. But back then, you had such as Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You had Black, quote unquote, Black Wall Streets. I kind of hate that term to compare it to Wall Street, but that's what they compared it to then. But affluent Black neighborhoods in Northern Florida, in Wilmington, North Carolina, in Georgia, and like I said, in Tulsa, that was the biggest one. They had airplanes, libraries, they had teachers, scientists. I mean, all of these businesses flourished and they were burned to the ground. And the reason they were burned to the ground was literally there were racist white policemen who came in. The entrepreneurs were jealous. They said they're making too much money. They burned it to the ground. Okay. If that happens today, of course, there should be a bigger uproar. But at the time it happened, people died and then just went away. In fact, people are so oblivious to this story. The show Watchmen actually showed this in detail in the first scenes of Tulsa, Oklahoma. And people were complaining, saying it was too graphic. And then they had to respond and say, this is actual history. This actually happened. They bombed a neighborhood because they were too affluent. And when they tried to build it up, if you look at it today, mostly Black people gone. It's gone. So now what I think about when I talk about maybe that same concept is that we don't need brick and mortar places. We can have that globally. And also we don't have to do it alone. We can work together, because Bitcoin, the best part about Bitcoin is that we can all work together and never meet each other. That's the best part. So as a community, we can build a digital Black Wall Street globally. We can all communicate, use each other's resources, and we don't have to build these things that can be burned down. Because you can burn down buildings, you can't burn down Bitcoin. And that's what I like to tell a lot of people when they talk about group economics. You can't get rid of Bitcoin if you try it, so you might as well use it to bring each other together. And we don't have to like each other. That's the best part. There are people who may hate other groups of people. If you're all using Bitcoin financially, we don't have to talk to each other because we're all getting rich together. Who cares? That separates a lot of people's beefs when you financially are where you want to be. And I feel like we can take advantage of that, and everybody can. It's just, you have to decide.
Right. Yeah. You can burn down buildings. You can't burn down Bitcoin. That kind of blew me away. It made me think a lot about the Bronx's burning in the 70s. Well, you know, another question I have is, what is the circulation of the black dollar like compared to other, you know, circular communities?
So the statistics on that, it is, I'll have to look, it's in the book, but it is nowhere near any of the other communities, such as the Asian American, the Jewish American community, some of the Chinese, Japanese Americans. Like, living in LA, I saw a lot of communities where the circulation of the dollar was prevalent. I like to use the Korean area of LA as an example, because they had so much group economics going. Their buildings were in Korean. They didn't even care if you spoke English. They were like, we don't care if you know what's here or not. Our community does. And the way it works with circulation of the dollar in your community is you can base it on whatever, because you can be religious, you can have racial, it can be whatever based on geographical places, doesn't matter. All you do is the people who have the regular jobs, their children go to school, they become doctors, lawyers, they come back to the neighborhood and they're their doctors and lawyers. They marry, they get back together, they have kids, they do the same thing. And I've seen this over and over in communities, and in black communities, even when we've tried, it's been burned to the ground. So now at this point, I'm saying, all right, we can practice group economics, but we don't have to all be in the same place. You know what's the best form of group economics? Is all being in Bitcoin. And as a group, we all use it as the base layer to build on top of, to build different communities, to build different technological advancements. All of these things can be built on top of it, and we don't have to necessarily, as a group, be in the same place, because it's hard, right? I mean, there are places like that. Atlanta, mostly black. PG County, outside of DC, mostly black. Great communities. But I'm talking about, you know, the dream of there being some utopia where black people can go and be free. I don't see that happening. You're going to have troubles wherever you go. Just live, but also work together globally with Bitcoin and in blockchain technology if you choose.
Yeah. The way I really most relate to that is, growing up in New York, you saw a lot of circular economies, like you were saying, like with either Chinatown or, you know, a lot of Jewish neighborhoods, Koreatown, whatever it may be. I gleaned from that is there was a lot of power in that.
Yes.
Almost like at first you're intimidated, you don't feel welcome. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that you're not welcome. I'm just saying that they are like kind of circular and taking care of themselves. They could police their own streets. Yep. They have their own lawyers, accountants, security, whatever it is, hospitals, healthcare. It's just embedded in their own circular community. And I think there's a lot of power in that, and not power in terms of the intimidation factor, but also helping all the people of that community rise and move forward. So I find that really interesting. One question I have for you is, they used to talk about Harlem being the capital of Black America, or Bedford-Stuyvesant, or I think more recently Atlanta. Is there a quote unquote capital of Black America? Or are we more decentralized now? Or is it just a misnomer and it's silly?
I would say, if there was a capital, it'd be Atlanta, but there's no such thing, right? I mean, Atlanta is a very affluent city, mostly Black, but there's no capital. And we all live in the same United States. Capital is DC, and DC used to be, I guess it still is, mostly Black, kind of changing demographically, but whatever, we don't need it anymore. I mean, I think that's what we're learning with the pandemic and everybody working remote and the ability to work from anywhere. Like, I can live in Asia. It doesn't matter. Like, our community is still our community online. We can all work together. So I'm glad that that's happening now, because these places exist, but I mean, what exactly, you know, we don't necessarily need them. And that's what I think gives you more power. Because when people are like, well, you can only congregate together, so if we get you all in one spot, that doesn't matter anymore. So I think that makes us stronger.
Yeah. I used to think a lot about it with like music, though. It was like wherever the heartbeat of like for me, I was a hip hop head, and wherever hip hop was emanating the strongest from was like where I was kind of vibing the most or something like that. And for a long time, that was New York City.
I feel sorry, man, for New York. Yeah, I had it for so long.
So much. And it was like the heartbeat of New York was like hip hop. And that was so interesting to me, is like, when I grew up, like, we were all listening to Run DMC. I didn't know I was listening to hip hop. I was just listening to what was on the radio. And that was what we were, you know, vibing to or something. It wasn't until later where I really started thinking about like different genres of music and how people start, you know, especially in high school, people choose like this genre of music is who I am. And you go deeper down those rabbit holes. But I'm also thinking about in 2014, you mentioned in the book that you started to look at Bitcoin through the lens of desperation rather than inspiration. And I'm kind of curious what you meant by that.
Yes. So going back to when I said first getting into Bitcoin, there were people who were like, hey, what do I have to lose? I already don't make any money. Let me see if I can make it with Bitcoin. That's how I thought of it. And I had to change that because moving to the emancipation phase, as I describe it, was more of the freedom aspect. The fact that I can send money at any time. I can store my own wealth. Nobody can take it from me. Technology-wise, I can build on top of it. I can actually have a community of people worldwide. All of this was the emancipation, the freedom. That's what led me down the path of where I am today with owning a farm or with making sure I have my own water source. Like these are all aspects of freedom. Make sure you have the ability to have security with guns and whatnot, having real estate. All these things allow you the freedom that I've been looking for, and Bitcoin kind of started that. Cause it's like, man, you free the money, you free everything else. It's like, well, I can do what I want, you know, within reason, but you know, that's sort of what took me down that path and I love it.
Oh yeah. So, you know, I'm kind of curious, you had that Max Kaiser quote in the book, and I'm kind of curious what you made of it in terms of, you know, it was kind of like a little bit of a braggadocio boast and a troll at the same time, I felt, where he's like, well, you know, and I don't want to say too much. Maybe if you want to just take, I would like to hear your thoughts without me saying more.
Well, I think he figured out what I figured out. I'm looking at this technology. I'm looking at the value of it go exponentially. I've never seen anything like this. Like I had some stocks gifted to me when I was 18 and I think I made like 7% the first, and I was like, Jesus Christ, this is what it takes to get rich. This is not gonna happen. And then when you see Bitcoin and it goes up 10,000%, I'm watching this the same time that he put that out. So what I think he thought was, if the Black community who's having financial problems had this Bitcoin, there wouldn't be any financial problems. And that's exactly what I thought. I think he just said it in a certain way. That's Max Kaiser's, you know, style. That's his shit, right? That's his style. Yeah. I didn't really take offense to it because technically he was correct. And the way he said it, buying the white community, like I say in the book, I didn't necessarily agree with that, but I understood what he meant. I know what he's talking about. The fact that if our problem is coming from a system that is perceived as, you know, white racial overlords, then you can get money and then never have to deal with them. But again, it was more of the fact that you can free yourselves using Bitcoin. It's not necessarily about that. And him being a white man, I think it made it ironic. And which made it funny to me. Like,
yeah.
Just like, what? I mean, just the first time I saw it, that was one of the first tweets of his I ever saw. So it was just hilarious to me. And Max is still a good friend to this day. So it's just a thing to me that, you know, when it came, when he wrote it and then seeing it later, I didn't see anybody offended. I was laughing. I didn't take the offense to it. I just thought it was a lighthearted joke.
Yeah. I loved it. I wrestled with it for a while before I loved it. I came to terms with it as just being truthful and honest and, yeah, I had no offense to it. It was written in a way that's tongue in cheek and a little like funny. So you're like, should I be offended? Should people be offended? And it just I didn't know who he was at the time, you know? And I wondered, like, you mentioned a couple of things there. So like, did the Black community invest are they invested in the stock market and the tech boom and things of that nature? And then we'll turn to Bitcoin.
So early on, no, I think, as I write in the book, we kind of missed that phase as far as being early. I still had friends in the 2000s who were like, why should I learn about typing? Who cares about computers? You know what I mean? Like, it was just crazy to me. I was like, you do understand this is the future. And, you know, in 02, 03, people were still kind of on the fence. I think the iPhone sped that up when it came out. People started realizing, you know, this is here. But before that, you know, we weren't in it early. We didn't have a lot of jobs at some of the top tech companies, not a lot of stocks, relatively low in the Black community. I think less than 20% during that time period. And I think now we've improved a lot. I think a lot of people with easier access, you can trade on, I wouldn't suggest it, but you can trade on Robinhood, you can get on, you know, some of these, these sites and actually have a portfolio in an app. All of these things that make it easier. So there has been a dramatic increase. People are starting to realize that assets are what grow. And in my current family and small group, everybody invests. So yes, and there was a point where it was just me and my uncles. And then now it's, you know, a whole family, hundreds of people that we've helped. And I'm sure they've told other people. So yes, definitely a big improvement.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the book really drives home that Bitcoin is a revolution. And you stressed that, you know, the Black people need to join the revolution. And so now I'd love to just turn about, you know, turn to like what you see going on now and what you're doing now. We talked a little bit about the show that you're doing on CoinDesk, but you have athletes like Russell Okung asking to get paid in Bitcoin. You got music and rappers talking about more a little bit NFTs now, but I think kind of like edging up again, kind of like maybe a little bit like the ICO craze and whatever, but we'll get through that one too. But like, what's going on now? You're talking about the summer camps. I'd love to get involved in those. What do you see at summer camps? What do you see with the education with the kids right now? But this is going to be a front loaded question. And like, what's going on? Are you getting out and going to meet with churches currently? What are the other networks in the Black community that maybe you're embracing with, and what do you see happening?
Well, in my hometown of Charlotte, my mom actually runs Innovative Learning. Again, she has her own after-school and summer camp. She's been doing it for 25 years. She had the first after-school for middle schoolers in Charlotte-Mecklenburg history back in 98. There was a time where middle school didn't even have after-school. She created it. So she's been around so long. And she's been to a lot of good churches and whatnot. She uses churches for a lot of these camps. The network is crazy in Charlotte as far as churches being able to get with them. A lot of the kids come through there. I'm not religious myself at all. My mom is a lot, but I'm not religious at all. But I do understand, like I wrote in the book, that 80% of the Black community attends some sort of religious service, and it's mostly churches in the South. So I do know where people are. And I think that introducing something like this to a group of people that frequent church, you know, getting this going, I think this summer camp is great. I think this won't be the last one. The first one actually was the Crypto Kids Camp by Naja Roberts out in Inglewood, California. Hers is on the West Coast, and I'm trying to put one on the East Coast in North Carolina. So if we can have that and then virtually reach kids wherever online, I think that's amazing. And this summer camp, we'll be teaching them, of course, about Bitcoin. They have their own Bitcoin wallets. We'll take them to Bitcoin ATMs as a field trip. We'll have them make NFTs, have them auction it off. We'll visit, you know, different virtual worlds, Decentraland, Crypto Voxels, just because I think the gamification of the space helps kids. We'll be giving them Dogecoin to spend and send just so they can see, even though, because I don't take it serious. I think kids should use it just to play around, and it's, you know, just something to learn. But of course, using that, looking how to program blockchains for some of the older ones. And then also, again, getting them exposed to the fact that this is the future and they should be in it now. So yeah, this summer camp, I can't wait for it. We are partnered with BitGive, so you can actually donate Bitcoin to the camp. We want to teach every kid for free. And not only the kids, we're teaching the adults. I'm doing a class for every adult who signs their kid up. They get free classes as well. So should be interesting. In a big banking city like Charlotte, teaching a bunch of the parents about Bitcoin or having your kid come home and tell you about Bitcoin every day should be funny. So.
Yeah, that's great. That sounds awesome. I'm kind of curious also, maybe talking about a little bit of the older kids with colleges. In the book, you mentioned that Black college graduates is the highest it's ever been in American history. So I'd like to just kind of ask you, like, what do you see kind of happening from that, even just in the current and down the road? But B, like, maybe what's happening at colleges with blockchain or Bitcoin and maybe endowments? I think Howard's got to have close to $1 billion now. Mm-hmm. Have you heard any buzz about, like, you know, institutions, Black institutions moving Bitcoin onto their balance sheet or accepting payment?
I have not heard it, but what I have heard is are people who are at these institutions bringing it up. So now we have alumni sending in letters saying, hey, have you thought about endowments? Hey, have you thought about having a blockchain group or Bitcoin group on campus? So we're getting there. And I think with a lot of the HBCUs around the country, like I stated in the book, all of the schools that have endowments that have exposure to crypto are killing it right now. And they're already rich. Harvard, MIT, Stanford, they already have money. And then they just realize they have a small exposure to crypto companies or crypto itself, and they're killing it. So at this point, much like a lot of these large companies are realizing that are putting Bitcoin on their balance sheet, I think HBCUs would take hold. And I think some of the work that I'm doing with companies like Visa and some of the other ones I can't name, but some of the stuff I'm doing with them is to fund these blockchain groups so that we can get students into it. And I think if they start realizing that the power of this, they can, you know, do internships at these companies. You can have students, like I said, pipeline straight into the industry. That's great. I think everybody wins that way. And then you have, you know, on average, a blockchain engineer makes about 30% more. You would have a population of HBCU students who would actually have an advantage, which is usually the opposite. You go into a junior level, everybody's paid, you know, whatever wage. But if you're going to an industry that's 30% more, you're ahead of your peers already. So I like that. And I like the fact that people are starting to get involved.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree. Well, I'd like your thoughts on the Occupy Wall Street movement and just protesting mm-hmm. in general and sort of like the implications for the Black community.
And I thought it was weak. I didn't think it did enough because people were just outside of banks, intense, kind of saying kumbaya. Hey, we don't like you, banker. That doesn't work. I know some bankers that are cold-hearted. They would have laughed all the way down the street, which probably most of them did because you didn't impact them. You didn't affect their bottom line. You don't have to do anything to bankers. If you take their money from them, they'll kill themselves. They've already proven that. They'll jump off of buildings when this market crashed in 07. People were committing suicide because their money went away. So you don't have to do anything to bankers. And really, from a, you know, when people talk about doing something violent, nobody should be doing that. The problem is, it doesn't even work really, right? Because they always have more people. It's the money. That's what you have to focus on. You have to disconnect. You have to have leverage. And I think that Occupy Wall Street, to me, it didn't do anything. It just has a good name and people showed up. But I think it did start the conversation, which I do thank them for that, because a lot of people didn't understand what was going on. But I wish, you know, back then they had Bitcoin, because what was it, 08? I think Bitcoin had just started. And if they had, like, if it had been around 10 years at that time, and people mm-hmm. also added that, you know, I think it would have had more impact. But unfortunately, it wasn't around. And now we have the ability to protest peacefully with Bitcoin. You don't have to go outside to protest with Bitcoin. Even if you're the laziest person on earth, all you have to do is push buy. All you have to do is move your savings out of their system. That's it. And that is a protest within itself. And that gives you leverage. If you want to have any dealings with the political realm, it's a business deal. You got to have leverage in business.
Yeah. Yeah, on that note, you also mentioned in the book that Black men and women who join these protests are more likely to be arrested and physically subdued by the police. I also want to ask you, like, what is the state of household wealth in Black America?
Currently, unfortunately, it hasn't risen much since the Civil Rights Act. And a lot of people who, after the Civil Rights Act, thought, you know, hey, everything's great now. Actually, what happened was the quote unquote forcing equal rights. Most of that money that goes towards civil rights actually goes towards white women, because they can claim that they're oppressed and the civil rights happened with them. So it's a downward spiral as soon as it happened, in my opinion, because equality of opportunity is not equality of outcome. You can't give people an outcome and then expect everything to be equal. That's not how it works. You get equal opportunities. That's what we should have been fighting for. Separate but equal. I don't know if that works potentially, because we wouldn't have stayed separate. But the thing is, people should have been left to their own devices to create equality, not force it on people. Because when that happened, a lot of the Black smart people in the Black community, a lot of the educated people, they started going to predominantly white institutions. They left HBCUs. The best athletes started going to predominantly white institutions. They took all their money there. Then what happened was, you have all this talent leave. They make money. They don't come back because they're like, now I don't want to go back to this neighborhood. It's the hood. It's poor. It's broke. It's blah, blah, blah. Even though every other race usually does that. They don't avoid their own community because of the separation of the money. So I think that, that was a pretty big impact. And I think since that point, our wages have stayed stagnant, which has affected everybody. But in the Black community, if the wages were already bad and then they stay stagnant, I mean, good gracious, how much higher can you go? That's why you see almost a flat line, an increase from 1964 to now. And that, to a lot of people, may be surprising, because some people are like, I thought you wanted civil rights. I'm sorry. I don't need a government document to tell me that I have human rights. This is a human rights thing. I have human rights. And that's what we should have been fighting for. I'm a human. I have my own clarity. That's what we should have been fighting for, actually. And since that time, I've been proven right, because nothing's happened financially for us. I mean, you see us rising and then that happens, flatline. And I think that was part of the plan, was to keep us just there and keep us kind of docile, not really, you know, improving, innovating. Because it wasn't a push for entrepreneurship until now. Now it's changing. And a lot of the old model stuff is broken. And I think that we'll improve, because a lot of that thinking has gone into improving our well-being and not worrying about, I'm going to stay at this job for 60 years till I retire just to get a watch. No, that time's dead. We literally, nobody in our generation stays anywhere for like 5 years, I think the number is. So 5 to 7 years. So I think that time is dead. People are looking for opportunity, much more information. So we have that opportunity. So.
Yeah. Wow. I really appreciate everything you said there, especially around entrepreneurship. And so I'm kind of curious, how do you see a peer-to-peer system like Bitcoin make people more inherently entrepreneurial?
Oh, yeah. I love the fact that once people learn about the industry and the things that you can do, For one, when you transact, you have a ledger, so you're already accounting. And then on top of that, if you're selling goods or if you're doing things with Bitcoin, that is a part of it as well. And I think some of the things that you have to know as an entrepreneur, your own security, how to hold your own funds. All of these things are sort of the entrepreneurial spirit that goes into it. And then also research. As an entrepreneur, you're constantly reading, trying to stay up to date, have to do the same thing with Bitcoin. And I think a lot of people who get into it start their own business simply because they start to see what that takes. And then they say, hey, I want to earn Bitcoin, or I want to do something that I can get more money to buy more Bitcoin. People start podcasts, people start magazines, people sell clothes, people begin doing or start exchanges. People, you know, all these things I think happens, but entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. a lot of people start businesses, a lot of people, and I love it. And in the Black community, I think we kill two birds with one stone, right? You get to have Bitcoin, the hardest money ever made. And then you get an introduction to what an entrepreneur is like and how you can start your own business without anybody stopping you. All of that works hand in hand. So it would definitely help.
Yeah. Awesome. I agree. You dedicated the book, I hope I get this right, to Ermias Nipsey Hussle Ashkadam. I love hip hop, and I'm not saying that he was involved in hip hop. He was a blind spot for me. So can you just kind of like tell us a little bit about like his impact on why what made you dedicate the book to him, and sort of what was his impact on the community?
Oh yeah. So mainstream, a lot of people didn't know him mainstream, which was great for me because my favorite rappers are usually underground rappers who build themselves up through entrepreneurship. Master P, Nipsey Hussle is another one. The guys over at Cash Money, being able to be underground and still make a lot of money in Oakland, too short, and still make a lot of money, become a millionaire, and then be able to build, because Nipsey also actually was one of the only people in his neighborhood. He owned an entire block or corner in his neighborhood of South Central Los Angeles in the middle of a gang neighborhood. He was a part of a gang, but he reformed himself to start a business, put that there, helped a lot of people in the area. So it's not well known to mainstream, but what his vision, his ability to take a bad situation, turn it into good, turn it legit. And then, of course, he started speaking about crypto in 2017. Unfortunately, I think he kind of fell in the path of the ICO wave. He was saying something about Follow Coin. I wish I could have talked to him before so that we could have gotten the Bitcoin phase. But he was actually in the process of building a workspace called Vector 90. I went to go visit it. And he was actually building a space where people could actually come do work, blah, 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 and a coffee shop right in the middle of a neighborhood that most people would never visit. So that's why I was impacted when I moved to LA. Never got the chance to meet him. Still regret to this day that I didn't take more of initiative, because, you know, you just think, oh, I'll see him at some point. You know, we're both in LA. I'm talking about Bitcoin. He's talking about Bitcoin. We'll link at some point, and then boom. Unfortunately, he passed away. But yes, he is a big figure. And I think a lot of people can learn, a lot of people in my community especially can learn that where you start is not where you have to finish. He wasn't a gang. He did have his troubles. But he ended up at 33 years old being a millionaire with a business right in the middle of a neighborhood most people wouldn't set foot in. Now they're going to name a corner after him. He invested in a lot of tech companies. He had one of the first clothing lines with a QR code on it where you could scan it. And it was almost like an NFT, but it wasn't called that back then. You could scan a QR code and watch a music video of his if you bought his clothing. And that was 2017 he was doing that. Like, who does that? What rapper from the middle of South Central does that? So I think he had a definite, man, it's crazy to think about. He had so much going on. I was like, man, I wish he would have stayed around. But Nipsey Hussle, big name. People should know. Shout out to him and his family. Definitely want to link with his family at some point. And I think a lot of people should look him up and read his story.
Yeah. I mean, his story is incredibly inspiring. I mean, just the outpouring of emotion was inspirational. Yeah. When he passed away, and it was just obvious the effect this person had on the community. I just never really knew him as a rapper. Like, I love a lot of underground hip hop, like MF Doom and Mos Def and Talib Kweli. I just never came across. I know Too Short and all those other guys you mentioned. I just never came across Nipsey, and I just haven't had the time to really explore him as a rapper. But it was obviously just really like, it kind of almost reminded me of like when Biggie came down the street in Bed-Stuy and the whole neighborhood was bumping. It just had that kind of energy. For LA. And you know, one of the things you mentioned in the book that I just want to quote is that if you work for a bank, unfortunately I have to flame your profession. And you weren't trying to diss anyone, and you were like, maybe you should use your skills for something a little better in the world. And you also mentioned, I want to quote you, that the most important aspect of politics is money. Let's face it, whoever can raise the most money will usually win the political race. No broke boys allowed in the political game. And then you mentioned that, you know, Blacks around the globe need to prepare for the next 100 years. So that's kind of going to be my last question for you, is like, what do you see playing out for the Black community over the next 100 years? And then, you know, I'll roll that into just, you know, the world and all communities and Bitcoin.
Oh, yeah. So we should be preparing for a tech-based world that will extend beyond the Earth, because in 100 years, I think that will be the case. And I just think that when I say that, I think that we just have to be forward thinking. We have to stop relying on what happened in the past to impact what we're doing now. We have to start looking forward to what we're going to do from this point. I understand that things happen. I understand that there's racism. I understand that there's certain things in your way. But as a man, I can't look my daughter in the face and not have a plan for the future. And I think people get too caught up in what's happening now. I'm thinking about literally, like, the ideas I'm telling you about with the summer camp. The reason I'm doing that summer camp is because I want a 10-year-old to be able to be the best Bitcoin tech person ever. And then they do the same thing. So part of the 100-year plan is working with kids. I also think we should be looking a lot into artificial intelligence and how that interacts with our job market, because in 100 years, it's not going to be a lot of service workers. We're already seeing it. McDonald's has like 3 people in there now, and the rest are machines. You go to the grocery store, and Walmart has 2 employees, and the rest are, it's literally computers are taking over. So we have to be tech-focused and think forward. Next, we also have to realize that the world is a big place. In America, a lot of people like it here, it's fine, but I think we'll have more of a people who travel spread out, and then over these next 100 years, I think our plan should be to establish ourselves anywhere in the globe, but stay connected through tech. Because like I said, we don't have to be in the same place, but I think our impact could be felt everywhere. So we have to start planning for that. Get your kid a passport, get yourself a passport, travel, see other places. The U.S. may not be a great place for Bitcoin, you know, but I think in the next 100 years, we have to plan for that. All of these things need to come into play. Fresh food sources, we have to start thinking about stuff like that. The ability to get your own water, securing your Bitcoin, because I think you will be able to make transactions to outer space, either between satellites and Mars, or they'll be doing something there. I think that'll happen the next time. We have to start thinking like this. Like, it may sound crazy, but to some people, but I'm like, I think crypto has an even bigger use case than humans. Robots will be using it to pay for maybe mining in Mars, and crypto will be paying that robot automatically, which, you know what I mean? It's a lot that happens. Got to be ready for it. Always thinking forward. So I think that's where we need to start. And I think China has done that already. I think, you know, some other countries have done that already. They have 100-year plans, 50-year plans. And if we're a group, we have to start thinking like that. Like, what are we going to do in the next 100 years? How are we going to get better? So everybody has to do it. And I'm just looking forward to it, because it should be fun.
Yeah, I really like the way you think. I agree with everything you said, especially around the macro thinking, the 100-year plan, group thinking, and even your own personal long-term plan. On the micro level, I'm trying to frame up the future with a lot of certainty. I think there's just a credible amount of uncertainty in the world. Since I've found Bitcoin, I've found more certainty in my life. And now I feel like I have a resolution and I've resolved the issue of uncertainty, where I know that I'm going to focus on my time, which I put into my family. And I put my time into Bitcoin, and I take care of those three things the most. And that is the thing I'm certain about into the future, regardless of all those externalities. Whatever comes my way, I'm just going to focus on those three things. But yeah, I really agree with everything you said there. And I just also want to open it up to, is there anything that we didn't cover or that you want to get into?
No, not really. I think we covered a good amount. I just wanted to really discuss the book. You know, things that I have going on. I got a lot of stuff, but you know, those are the main ones.
Yeah, well, I love the book. Like I said, I mean, I was super excited before I got my hands on it. I bought it as soon as I could. I enjoyed it thoroughly. I really enjoy this notion of having a dialectic conversation about race and communities. And you know, and I think it's great when people speak to their own community or any community. And a lot, and like, I think anyone could pick up this book and apply it to their own life and their own community, if that's how they want to see it on a macro level. So I think the book is fantastic. I think it's for everybody. And you know, it's funny. I wonder, I have no idea what your audience is like for the book. But you know, sometimes I go to hip hop shows and it's more white people at the show than
it's
black people.
50-50.
And
you know, that's what's crazy. A lot of people have it, but it is about 50-50, because
right.
I think Bitcoiners realize it's for everybody. So
yeah,
of course,
it's for everybody.
And
so like, I think the title kind of like, just, you know, kind of is a positive thing in the sense that like, it just might stand out in a way. It was like, oh, I could learn about Bitcoin and just apply this to my own life. And so I was really excited to chat with you and have this conversation. This has been so dope. I just want to thank you so much. And I'll leave it to you for any parting words. And definitely, I know you have a lot going on, so definitely front anything that you want to feature where people could find you, where they could buy the book, what's coming out with the next volume, et cetera.
Absolutely. Twitter, you can find me at Bitcoin Zay, and BitcoinandBlackAmerica.com. You can get the first and second edition, BitcoinandBlackAmerica.com. You go there, you can purchase it, or you can contact me on Twitter.
Are you on Clubhouse?
Yes, on Clubhouse, under my name, Isaiah Jackson. But we have the biggest Bitcoin group, Black Bitcoin Billionaires in the world, on Clubhouse. We have a bunch of rooms, Bitcoin Breakfast, Crypto Virgins Hour. We do Who Wants to Be a Satoshi Millionaire. We have a lot of different ways to get people involved, teach them about Bitcoin. And it, again, Bitcoin is for everybody. This group is for everybody as well. But just wanted to make sure we reach out to our community so they have good information as well.
Very cool. This has been so dope. Thank you so much, sir. Isaiah.
Thank you, brother. Appreciate it. Peace. Peace.
Isaiah Jackson on Bitcoin, Black America, and why the digital revolution will not be televised, right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dug the chat, please subscribe, rate with a dope 5-star review, and share a link to the pod with your friends and family. And if you need to start stacking sats or want the best place to DCA, plus get $10 of Bitcoin free on me, just sign up at swanbitcoin.com/Cedric Jungelman. That's the first step. This is Cedric. Peace.